Thanks for being here and giving me some time to share with you. I don't have anything feminine specific to discuss today, but I did promise Brad that I would try to tie into psychedelics. So we'll see how it goes. today, I want to start with a story. I was telling, you know, our friends back in talk, pre-talk this morning, that I've been fascinated by the Genesis story of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And I'm sure many of you know it. Probably some of you know it very well, but I would like to tell it to you again now. And whether you see it as fiction, as nonfiction, or as something in between, I hope you're able to listen with the same wonder as if I were sharing a story or a myth that wasn't familiar to you. So to help us listen to it with fresh ears, this is the story of the tree of knowledge of good and evil as told by AI. The guardians and the serpent's bargain. Long ago, when the great tree of all secrets grew mighty in the heart of an enchanted garden, the great maker chose two souls to be its guardians, Adam and Eve. He gave them one solemn charge: eat freely from every branch, save the highest, where hangs the fruit of good and evil. The day you taste it, you shall lose your innocence forever. The guardians delighted in their sacred duty, walking beneath the tree's canopy in perfect happiness, knowing only good, understanding only light. But in the garden's shadows lived an ancient serpent, beautiful as polished bronze and cunning beyond measure. Once he had served in the courts of wisdom, but pride had cast him into exile, and now he burned with envy for those who still walked in grace. One twilight, as Eve passed near the great tree, the serpent wound down from above, his scales catching the light like jewels. "Noble guardian," he called with a voice smooth as silk, "has the great maker truly forbidden you to eat from every fruit of this tree?" "We may taste all wisdom save one," Eve replied. "The highest fruit we must not eat, lest we die." The serpent's eyes glittered with dark amusement. "Die, my dear child, you have been deceived. You shall become like gods, knowing good and evil, understanding mysteries hidden from you. Why remain simple guardians when you could reign as queens of wisdom?" Under his spell, the forbidden fruit seemed to glow with irresistible beauty. Eve reached up, plucked it, and tasted starlight and storm clouds all at once. She called to Adam, who came running. Though dread filled his heart, he could not bear separation from his beloved. He too ate. In that instant, their innocence shattered like crystal. They saw themselves truly, not as noble guardians, but as naked, vulnerable creatures who had betrayed their trust. Shame crashed over them, and they hid what they heard, and they hid when they heard the great maker walking in the evening breeze. "Have you eaten from the forbidden fruit?" he asked, his voice heavy with infinite sorrow. "The woman gave me the fruit," Adam accused. "The serpent deceived me," Eve confessed. And so the great maker pronounced their bitter harvest. The serpent was cursed to crawl upon his belly. Eve would know sorrow in all her works. Adam would struggle against thorns and stones. Both would one day return to dust. Most grievous of all, they could no longer guard the tree. The great maker, weeping for his children, sent them forth from the garden and set mighty cherubim with flaming swords to guard the way back. And so the first guardians walked into the wide world, carrying the terrible burden and strange gift of knowing good from evil, knowledge that would echo through all their children until the end of days. I have many questions about this story. Was it normal to have a talking snake in the garden? Did other animals talk? Why were all of the snakes cursed? Because of one sneaky snake. It seems like the other snakes were unfairly punished. What was outside of the garden? Had Adam and Eve been there before? Had they been allowed to leave and come back freely? And most pressing, if the great maker didn't want Adam and Eve to eat from the tree of knowledge, why put the tree in the garden in the first place? I don't have an answer for those questions right now. But this isn't the first time we've experienced a myth or a story where things got a bit strange. Whatever the reason, somewhere in this beautiful, enchanted garden grew the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. To be honest, it sounds like a pretty helpful tree. As Francis Bacon said, knowledge is power. Possessing knowledge allows people to exert influence, make informed decisions, and gain an advantage in various aspects of life. It sounds like an important tree. It's just sitting there in the garden, and these guardians are supposed to not eat it. How can this possibly go wrong? Even if you hadn't heard the story before, it's clear that Adam and Eve are going to eat the mysterious fruit. Convinced by the talking snake, they eat from the tree, and suddenly Adam and Eve become self-conscious. They notice they're naked. They feel shame about breaking their promise to the great maker. We are all familiar with this change in attitude. The same kind of awakening happened in us, too, somewhere around middle school. I have one who's getting close to middle school. She starts tomorrow. While we'd had opinions about the other people around us, we realized that others probably have opinions about us, too. Our bodies changed. Some of us started to care about how our clothes fit. Hanging out with mom and dad becomes uncool. Maybe you told a funny joke and some of your classmates laughed. That's good. Maybe you told another joke and no one laughed. That's bad. Maybe you will not tell any more jokes. We all have inherited the power of the tree, the pressure to cover up our vulnerabilities, to hide our nakedness follows us well beyond puberty. What Adam and Eve really gained wasn't knowledge in the sense of facts. They learned that other beings might judge them and that they could judge themselves. For years, I've wondered if we should call it the tree that told Adam and Eve that good and evil exists, because that's what it gave them. Suddenly, they could categorize things as good or bad. They felt inadequate and exposed. Was it possible that they themselves might be bad? How many of you feel totally comfortable with AI? Anybody? Who has at least a little bit of skepticism? Yeah, okay, that's right. AI processes vast amounts of data and identifies patterns very quickly. It generated our tree of knowledge story in about 1 minute with just a few parameters. But computers cannot think, empathize, or reason, and they struggle to differentiate good from bad without programmed boundaries. About 2 weeks ago, I saw a post from The Atlantic where some reporters were able to get ChatGPT to provide instructions for causing self-harm, including deep breathing exercises when the reporters told ChatGPT that they were feeling nervous about the process. With the right questions, the journalists were able to bypass the self-harm safeguards that programmers had put into place. We've created infinite access to knowledge, a tree of knowledge. But knowledge without understanding its impact is dangerous. Differentiating good and bad is vital for human survival. You don't need to know the difference between good and bad when you're wandering through a perfect garden where the land grows infinite food and the lions are lying down next to the lambs and the weather is always 78 degrees. Your great maker shows up for evening strolls and you can give him a face-to-face rundown on your daily activities. It's like being with young children. My kids, especially when they were younger, know that I, the great maker, yes, will have their food ready for mealtimes. I hold their hand when they cross the street and put up barriers on their beds so they don't roll out in the middle of the night. They run around naked and they don't care very much about the thermostat. But we don't live in the magic garden. And if our awareness stayed like young children, we wouldn't survive long enough to continue the species. Knowing and being able to identify good versus evil or bad protects us and keeps us alive. As we age, this awareness multiplies. We identify good and bad to avoid pain and death. Knowing becomes a powerful weapon against fear. I recently finished a book called The Measure. It's a fiction novel by Nikki Ehrlich. Has anybody else read it? Okay, a couple. It has a really great hook. One morning, every adult wakes up to find a mysterious wooden box sitting on their doorstep, inscribed with their name. Each box contains a red string whose length correlates to that person's lifespan. Also included is the message, "The measure of your life lies within." Brandon, we would know, so that beautiful song that you sang about not knowing, in this book, it wouldn't work. I'm sorry, but I'm glad you could sing it here. I want to mention one spoiler-free scene that haunts me from the book. A newlywed couple decides to open their boxes together. It turns out that the wife has a very short string, meaning she'll die soon. But her husband has a long one. Because of this knowledge, and to head off whatever horrible thing is coming for the new bride, the couple jumps off a bridge together. The wife dies as predicted, but her husband survives. Would the wife have died if the couple hadn't looked? Was the string only reporting what the couple did to themselves? Nikki Ehrlich, the line from The Measure is in your bulletins, and she says, "Once you know something, you forget what it was like not to know it." Once we know good and bad are options, it's hard to imagine a world without these categories, but this knowledge can complicate life's complexity. Nearly a decade ago, I photographed a wedding for a couple in their mid-70s. The bride had been married for over 40 years before her husband died unexpectedly in a biking accident just a few years before. This tragedy led her to reconnect with her groom-to-be, and they were starting a new adventure together. Was the bike accident good or bad? I recently saw a Facebook story from Humans of New York about David Faschenbaum. During medical school, he was diagnosed with Castleman's disease, a rare incurable condition. After multiple relapses and reaching the maximum chemo dose humans can tolerate, doctors told David that the next relapse would kill him. David says, "I only had one hope, a tiny hope, but a hope. I had to cure the disease myself. It takes $1 billion and 10 years to create a new drug. I didn't have the money or the time. My only chance was to discover an existing drug that would work. I made spreadsheets of every similar disease and every drug used to treat it. I wrote over 2,000 emails to every doctor who'd published a paper on Castleman's. I started studying samples of my own blood, but I ran out of time. Another relapse put me back in the ICU. From my hospital bed, I asked the doctor to cut out one of my lymph nodes. I took it to the lab and discovered a particular protein called MTOR. Is that how you say that? MTOR. He's in science. MTOR that was sending my immune system into overdrive, and that's when I knew. I knew from my research that a drug called sirolimus inhibits MTOR. My doctor was hesitant to prescribe it. There was no research to support my theory, but he took a chance. And within days, my symptoms began to disappear. I still take the pill every day 11 years later. I was able to marry my wife and have two beautiful kids. And through my work, I've been able to save thousands of lives by repurposing 14 different drugs to treat rare diseases. Was David's diagnosis of Castleman's good or bad? My dad is a truck mechanic, and he finally opened his own shop when I was in high school. It was a big deal for my family because I knew somehow that this was something he had always wanted to do, and my parents pulled together a lot to make it happen. I still feel at home when I smell grease or I go into the car repair shop. Unfortunately, like the majority of new businesses, it failed, and the aftermath was very difficult for our family. But something stuck with me from their risk-taking, my parents' risk-taking. Some deep part of me believes chances are worth taking. Today, I stand before you, an award-winning filmmaker, for the first time. Thank you. Thanks largely in part to my parents demonstrating that risks can be worthwhile, even when the end result is bad. There's a Chinese parable made famous by Alan Watts that shows up in an episode of the children's television show Bluey, which is children's television at its finest. In the episode, Bluey is very sad that she has to move. Her teacher tells her the story of the Chinese farmer. Once upon a time, there was a Chinese farmer whose horse ran away. That evening, all of his neighbors came around to commiserate. They said, "Oh, we are so sorry to hear your horse has run away. This is most unfortunate." The farmer said, "Maybe." The next day, the horse came back, bringing 7 wild horses with it. And in the evening, everybody came back and said, "Ugh, isn't that lucky? What a great turn of events. You now have 8 horses." The farmer again said, "Maybe." The following day, his son tried to break one of the horses, and while riding it, he was thrown and broken. He broke his leg. The neighbors then said, "Oh, dear, that's too bad." And the farmer responded, "Maybe." The next day, the conscription officers came around to conscript people into the army, and they rejected his son because he had a broken leg. Again, all the neighbors came around and said, "Oh, isn't that great?" Again, he said, "Maybe." Alan Watts followed the story up with the following. "The whole process of nature is an integrated process of immense complexity, and it's really impossible to tell whether anything that happens in it is good or bad, because you never know what will be the consequence of the misfortune, or you never know what will be the consequences of good fortune. Life is complicated. Good and evil are entwined like yin and yang. Opposite forces that are actually complementary, interconnected, and interdependent. Opposite forces are actually complementary. They're interconnected, and they give rise to each other through their relationship. There is good, and there is bad. It's just tricky to know which is which. When looking at your own life, let moments of good wind around with moments of difficulty, because you never know when one river will flow into the other. I'm not advocating eliminating good and bad. These distinctions clearly matter, but they require balance. Before labeling something, ask, what are these judgments serving? And remember, your neighbor probably considers some things good that you deem bad, and vice versa. Look at religion or the news. If you want to see rampant good versus bad opinions, look up your favorite movie on any film review site. Your favorite film will probably have at least one critic, and a film you believe should never be shown again will be hailed by a masterpiece by someone else. I think we should start a film group at C3. I keep coming up with beautiful films that I'd like to share with anyone who is interested. For this talk, your homework is to go home and watch the film My Old Ass. Has anyone seen this? What do you say? It's a great movie. There we go. In it, 18-year-old Elliot meets her 39-year-old self during a birthday mushroom trip. Psychedelics. But when Elliot's older self, her old ass, starts handing out warnings about what younger Elliot should and shouldn't do, Elliot realizes she has to rethink everything about family, love, and what's becoming a transformative summer. The film highlights that we're not just knowing beings. Socrates said, "Knowing is not the same thing as doing." Maybe that's why psychedelics are becoming more and more intriguing. Finding ways to turn off our brain and tune into all of the other ways that we live in the world is important for our human flourishing. As Alice in Paradise, a couple of weeks, ultimately helped me conclude, our brain needs to integrate with our experience. If we declare that grief is bad, when grieving shows up, ourselves have trouble reconciling the conflicting positions. Some things we know, but that knowing doesn't come from our heads. I can tell you that I love Alex and my kids, but I know that not because my head tells me, I feel it here in my chest. I recently discovered the Buddhist concept of the koan. Those are short questions or dialogues that seem illogical used in Zen Buddhism. These are exchanges between a Zen master and a student, usually designed to provoke realization beyond rational thought. One of the most famous examples is, "You know the sound of two hands clapping. What is the sound of one hand clapping?" It's impossible to answer rationally, and that's the point. The monk carries the koan everywhere. Meditating, eating, cleaning, daily they present possible answers to the Zen master, who almost always says that they're wrong or they don't understand. The goal isn't to solve it through reason, but to think outside the confines of your mind, to provoke a mystical realization. Zen Buddhism sees language as limiting. Koans are designed so that solving them requires subverting language for a mind-transcending experience. I love this example. A frustrated student said, "Roshi," that's the spiritual leader of a community of Zen Buddhist monks, "Roshi, I don't understand what's going on. Felicia got enlightened when her water bucket broke. Todd got enlightened when you hit him with your staff. People work on koans and get enlightened, but I've been doing this for 2 years and the koans don't make sense. I don't feel enlightened at all. Can you just tell me what's going on?" "Well," Roshi replied, "for most people, especially educated people like us, what we experience is heavily mediated through language and deeply ingrained concepts. Our objective is to induce unmediated experience of the world. It's impossible to reach that state through any particular method, so we employ various ad hoc means, hoping one will engender non-mediated experience for each student. And since thinking in terms of mediators and goals reinforces our dependency on concepts, we actively discourage this analytical discourse." And the student was enlightened. Whenever I think about knowing something and being smart, a short Simpsons clip pops into my head. In Homer Goes to College, it's the title of this talk, by the way, Homer must attend college in order to keep his nuclear plant job. So looking at his acceptance letter, he shouts, "Woohoo! I'm a college man! I won't need my high school diploma anymore!" He walks over to his framed diploma and sets it on fire with a lighter. As the house burns down around him, Homer dances and sings, "I am so smart. I am so smart. I am so smart. I am so smart. SMRT. I mean, SMART. The SMRT was actually a mistake by Homer's voice actor that the creators kept in. Because when the universe gives you a mistake like that, don't mess with it. We sometimes have a reverence for knowledge that reminds me of Homer's celebration. What is all this knowledge for? How do we use it? I wonder how much of life is led by our thinking, knowledge-centric minds, heads that determine what is good and what is bad. If we know what is good and bad, in advance of experiencing it. Maybe, just maybe, then we can only experience good things. Last night, Alex told me about a new company called Orchid Health. I mean, it's not new, but it's in the news because the Twitter said some things, or the Twitter. The founder said some things on Twitter, and it should give you an idea of why she's becoming newsworthy. Find it here a second. She says, "What if your baby never walks? What if they are never able to live independently? What if you could have stopped it, but chose not to? That is the question Orchid's embryo screening forces. You optimize everything, career, diet, skincare, but you're going to chance it on your child's genome, one of the most significant determinants of their health? The most important parenting decision happens before conception. It's not the name, it's not the school, it's the genome. And that's the difference between a child who runs and laughs and one who never walks, never talks, dies at 5. Most kids are born by accident. And yet we stigmatize parents who plan ahead, who screen embryos to prevent deadly, now preventable diseases. If you wouldn't screen, fine. Just be honest. You're okay with your kid potentially suffering for life so you can feel morally superior. Or because you can't be inconvenienced for 2 weeks to extract eggs and check for genetic issues before they develop." That is a bold marketing strategy. When we decide what's good and bad before approaching the world with curiosity and empathy, we're no better than AI. Fear and commitment to preventing all pain can keep us from living. I'm not going to even talk about if it's good or bad, because I'm sure many people have many different ideas on the subject based on where you come from and what you've experienced and what you've seen. As I wrap up, I want to share a quote from Cole Arthur Riley's book, This Here Flesh. All right, I'm sorry, it's a different quote than what's in your bulletin. As I shaped this talk, so much came up that I didn't have time to get to rest, so maybe next time. Still from the same book, Riley says, "The curse of the world has made for restless hearts, bodies, minds. Our hands fidget. We open and close our emails. We obsess over something we said yesterday. It's like the atoms that make us have begun darting around in and outside of us with no awareness of each other. The current of the cosmos shifted, and now God is trying to steady us and make it so that we can be still without becoming terrified of things, of ourselves. When our knowing minds become obsessed with being good and right, we hold on to a power we were never capable of managing. May your awareness of good and bad give you information to make wise choices, but don't let it fuel fears or self-doubt. More knowledge will not save you. There is only the path forward, and it requires your whole human self, the parts that know beyond your mind, courage, and the trust that whatever you meet, good or bad, will pass away, will be a maybe, melting into the next step of life's great journey. Thank you.